Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagolani-Albov.
Today we're joined by Jesse Barber, a PhD student at the University of Helsinki, also a very dear friend of mine, who is going to share a lot of interesting insights into his work around folklore, pre-Christian Scandinavian religions. And yeah, we're just really happy to have him on. So Jesse, welcome to the show. Would you mind telling our audience who you are and what you do?
Hey, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm Jesse Barber. I'm a PhD student at the University of Helsinki. I study mainly pre-Christian Scandinavian religions, but I've also been looking at the sort of Finnish folklore and later Scandinavian folklore as well.
That is quite an interesting and niche field, I think. I'm sensing a North American accent here. So how did you end up studying this subject in Finland?
Yeah, so I, in my undergrad, I went to Western Michigan University, but throughout my undergrad, I did a short study abroad in Ireland and a year-long study abroad in Germany. And after experiencing academic life studies in Europe, I looked into studying in Europe for my master's, and I found this program in Iceland for international students called Viking and Medieval Norse Studies, and it was exactly what I wanted to do, and it was a lot cheaper than pursuing a master's in the States. So I went to Iceland, and during that program, I did some studying in Denmark and Aarhus, at Aarhus University as well, and one thing sort of led to another, and I ended up here in Helsinki doing my PhD.
Awesome. So I guess getting to your PhD, like, tell us a little bit more. What are you focusing on? I mean, pre-Christian Scandinavian religion is a huge thing. And of course, you're talking about like Finnish mythologies. And I mean, especially for our audience outside of the Nordic countries, what's the difference between Finnish mythology and other Scandinavian mythologies?
I mean, for my dissertation, I'm still focused mainly on just the Scandinavian stuff. What I'm doing for my dissertation, I'm basically comparing the worldview conveyed by the medieval sources for the Old Norse mythology with later sources for Scandinavian folklore centuries after conversion to Christianity, and comparing those two worldviews. How are they similar? How are they different? Although I have an article in the works that compares the Scandinavian god Odin with the Finno-Karelian god Vainamoinen, who's also a sort of folk character. But the difference between Scandinavian mythology and Finnish mythology, I'd say the biggest difference is the source situation. So the one thing you have to know about Old Norse mythology is that the sources that we have for it were written down 2 to 3 centuries after Scandinavian Christianization. So it's debatable to what extent these sources reflect the actual pre-Christian beliefs. And there's been a lot of debate about that in the field. But it is widely accepted now that the poems that we have that are depict these different myths do come from an oral tradition before Christianization, although they were probably in a different form. And then there's also questions of variation. But the Finno-Karelian stuff, and I say Finno-Karelian because a lot of the folk poems about the sort of Finno-Karelian mythology were actually recorded in Karelia, in Archangel Karelia or Vienna Karelia. And they were recorded much later, in a lot of them in the 19th century, by Elias Lönnrot, amongst others, although he's the one that wrote Kalevala. And he took these folk poems and sort of meshed them all together to create an epic story, because he sort of saw himself as the next Homer, you know, writing the Iliad in ancient Greece. Of course, it was to create a national identity for Finland. And he sort of saw, you know, Karelia and Finland as sort of the same thing, because they have similar languages, they have this similar history, they have the similar folk beliefs. And yeah, so he went walking from village to village recording folk poems and whatnot.
That's really interesting. You know, I've been living in Finland now for almost, I guess, 9 years. And I have to admit that, of course, I know what the Kalevala is, this epic poem that's, it was presented to me on my first visit to Finland, is like, here's the Kalevala, read this and you will know Finland. But I don't think I've ever thought too critically about it before. So it was actually kind of put together by someone. Like, I know that you gave a little bit of reference to when this happened, but when did this actually happen? And then also for our listeners, could you unpack a little bit more what Karelia is?
Yeah, no, for sure. The Kalevala is sort of an artificial construction by Elias Lönnrot. He collected a lot of folk poems and then sort of glued them together into his own sort of narrative, because he does sort of invent characters and invent scenes and different dynamics. And so Karelia is just northeast of Finland. Most of it is now in modern day Russia. But yeah, because it was so isolated, it has a sort of landscape that's comparable to Siberia, that there wasn't a whole lot of direct Christian influence there. The Eastern Orthodox priests that were sent there were usually being punished, and they were usually like alcoholics or something, you know, so they didn't really have any drive to witness and convert, you know, these people. But at the same time, of course, they knew some things about Christianity. There is one source that I've seen where somebody was interviewing this guy just after like Sunday service in Karelia. And he asked him, how do you think the world was created? And then he said, well, like, I think same as you, we're both Christians. And I think it's just as the story goes that, you know, Wainamoinen was floating through the primordial waters when an eagle laid an egg on his knee and then it broke. And that's where the sun and the moon comes from. And like, from the source, it sounds like it's, isn't that what we all believe, right? You know, like almost in this innocent confusion.
No, I mean, that's really fascinating. And, you know, this has me wondering, like, looking at this sort of mythology in the process of nation building and how even into the 19th century was still blending with Christianity, is this a sort of broad strokes kind of common thing across the Scandinavian / Nordic context of bringing in these mythologies to like blended with Christianization or with national identity?
It is to some extent. And that's sort of one of the things that my dissertation talks about. I've looked at like the different Christianization processes of different people from different parts of the world. In my undergrad, I did like a couple papers on Native Americans and their beliefs and how those blended with Christianity. I think whenever a people, a culture are Christianized, they sort of interpret it through their own cultural lens and it becomes sort of their own. So in Scandinavia, I have a few examples I could talk about. These myths that seem to survive Christianization. So in the mythology, there's a myth about the building of the wall of Ásgarðr, or Asgard, as we say in English. The gods hire this mysterious builder who, if he can build the wall within one winter's time, then they will give him the sun, the moon, and Freya. And of course, he does it. And the gods get really nervous because they don't actually want to have to pay him the sun, the moon, and Freya. And they get really nervous that he's going to complete it. So they distract him right before he could finish with putting the last stone in place. And then they end up getting Thor to kill him. There's also numerous folk legends in Scandinavia that are still being told centuries later that has the same sort of basic plot, but some of the characters are exchanged. So there's one like a specific variant from Norway where King Olaf Helgi, and that means Olaf the Holy, basically, because he was one of the kings largely responsible for Christianizing Norway. And he becomes a saint, but he also becomes a sort of legendary character. And there's a story about the building of a local church. And in order to build the local church, he gets this mysterious builder to help them build the church. And he promises him the sun and the moon as payment. if he can do it within a certain amount of time. And then, of course, he almost completes it. And just before he's about to put the last stone in place, then he ends up killing him. And I actually should have mentioned that in the mythological source, the builder turns out to be a Jotun or a giant. In the later sources, it turns out to be a troll. So there's a lot of parallels between some myths and some later folk legends.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier in talking about these myths and folk legends is the role that they've taken in nation building. And so what role have they taken in nation building in the Scandinavian countries? Because, I mean, you know, sitting here today in 2022, you know, we think of these places as it's a state. It is what it is. It's been this way forever. It's been my whole lifetime, which is, of course, like not that much in the scheme of things. But what role have these stories played in developing these modern places? Because, I mean, for any of our listeners that don't know, for example, Finland, as Finland, was only founded in 1917, which is actually quite recent.
Yeah, so I think with the Scandinavian experience, I think I should also say that the sources, I mean, that were written 2 to 3 centuries after Scandinavian Christianization, the vast majority of them come from Iceland. And so what they call mainland Scandinavia, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, they sort of latch onto that Icelandic tradition. I mean, Iceland's this really isolated island. So they were Christianized last, as far as the sources say. It's also, you know, a very remote island. But as soon as they got the written word, they really latched onto this tradition of making manuscripts and the written word, because, I mean, there's no television back then. I mean, so, like, reading and writing was... I think a big form of entertainment, but also they had some kind of drive to record their cultural history and all these stories about the different founders that came there. So talking about nation building, according to the sagas, I think he's a sort of pseudo historical figure. Harald Fairhair was the first king of Norway, and he's called Fair Hair because he vowed that he wouldn't cut his hair until he had all of Norway under his rulership. So he went around sort of displacing all these petty kings and making them pay tribute to him. And if they didn't want to pay tribute, then they basically had to either die or leave. And so in the sagas, it talks about that's where a lot of these first settlers came from, was from Norway. They were escaping this high king, Harald Fairhair, and coming and settling in Iceland. But I think because Scandinavia has, you know, stories like this, these sort of identities that have been recorded for centuries, that nation building and mixing mythology and the nation building wasn't as important as it was, I think, in a place like Finland, where they had been ruled by the Swedes for centuries, and then the Swedes lost them to the Russians and to the Russian Empire. And when the Bolshevik Revolution happened, Finland basically took its chance to break away from Russia. But I mean, before they were able to break away from Russia, they, you know, like a lot of places, were making their case for their own unique identity. And these stories, this mythology, these legends, these become very important in displaying their unique identity. They're like, this is our culture. We have these stories. These are our old beliefs, you know, because I mean, when you're all part of Christendom, then you have to have something that sets you apart from other Christian countries. And the pre-Christian mythology and folklore in general became a way to set yourself apart from, like, how is Finland different than Sweden? How is Finland different than Russia? I mean, in Scandinavia, it's been a mess. I always have this joke that at some point in Scandinavian history, everybody has ruled over everybody else. So like Norway has ruled over Sweden and Denmark, and Denmark's ruled over Sweden and Norway. And it goes on, like all these different, you know, land grabs and different governments and whatnot that have been put into place. But now they're all sort of stationary now in the modern era. But I think they've had their own identity for a long time.
It's really fascinating. And I'm really curious, kind of coming off of this and also touching a bit back on something you said earlier, like when you were talking about how in your master's looking at articles about Christianization in the quote unquote New World and how Christianity brings in those things of folklore. And of course, you know, with extractivism and colonialism, Christianization is a big factor. So I'm kind of curious here with these like oral traditions. And as you said, like it was Harold Fairhair chasing out people to Iceland. Was there marginalization of people who were non-Christian around this? Is there any evidence around that? Did Christianity play a role in Harold Fairhair kicking people out, or was it just a purely land grab?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to know about the Christianization of Scandinavia is that is what we call a top-down conversion. So the leaders converted, the kings converted to Christianity, and then they sort of enforced that upon their subjects. My old professor, Terry Gunnell, used to say that joining Christianity during the Middle Ages was a lot like joining the EU. You sort of become part of the club, and it opens up more trade and whatnot, because there's all these sort of medieval restrictions on trading with pagans. Like, it can be done, but you know, there's some holy and sacral bureaucratic loops to jump through or something, or it's frowned upon. But more than that, like these relationships that you get with the different leaders. There's a scholar, Anders Winroth, has this theory that kings would give to their sort of sworn men and people in their hearth, like that they would give them exotic gifts to reward them for their loyalty or their deeds, what have you. And one of those exotic gifts was Christianity. If they became Christianized, they could join this large European group, much like the EU, where you become part of this community. And now you're taken seriously by the community, and you have a lot more prestige, but you have a lot more things you can do, you know, and your horizons are broadened. And so now you, as a Scandinavian ruler who just converted to Christianity, now the only thing left to do is convert the rest of your country into Christians and to make it a good Christian country. Some of this was done by a force. The first Christian king of Norway, Olaf Tryggvason, converted to Christianity, and then he wanted to convert the rest of his country. And there's stories about him tying up resistant pagans to posts on the seaside at low tide, so that when the tide came in, they would slowly drown unless they converted to Christianity. And it wasn't always so forceful, but there is a lot of stories about converting people to Christianity by force. But on the other hand, there's also a story in some of the Icelandic sagas, I think Njál saga famously, about how they converted to Christianity. So they had what some people call the oldest parliament in the world. It's called the Thing, which must have been a good excuse, to get out of something back in the medieval Iceland. Like, no, I gotta go. I have a thing. And everybody would understand. Annually, they'd have the Althing at Þingvellir in Iceland, which is the spot that you can still go visit today as a tourist. They would camp out there, and they would decide matters of governance, and all the chieftains from all over Iceland would be there And they'd also settle smaller disputes about, you know, how Hrafnthor had stealed Egert's sheep or something, you know. But they would also decide sort of national matters. In Njal Saga, they have this scene where they're debating whether or not to become Christian. And they have the sort of moderator of the Althing, this sort of parliament. And the law speaker is going to make a decision on whether or not they will become Christian. So he tells everybody, listen, I'm going to go to my tent and I'm going to cover my face with a cloak and lay down. And when I get back up, I will have a decision about whether or not we will become Christian. So he does just that. Everybody waits around for a few hours while he's just laying down with a cloak over his head. And he comes back out and he says, we're going to become Christian, but there are three things that pagans can still do in this country. And one of them is that they can still sacrifice to the gods, but they have to do it in secret. They can't do it publicly. They can still practice infanticide, you know, leaving their children, unwanted children, out in the wilderness. This is a sort of early means of abortion. The last thing that they can still do is they can still eat horse meat. And some of these things are really apparent. And of course, you'd still want to sacrifice the gods. Infanticide seems kind of weird that it's such a vital part of what they would still practice or whatever. But the last one, the eating of horse meat is something that we talk about all the time. What does this mean? Like, what was this part of a ritual of eating horse meat that was important? Or like, why that one? Because we don't see it and a lot of different sources reappearing. It just sort of pops up randomly, and that's sort of the nature of the beast too with its source material. But that's how they became Christian in Iceland, according to the sagas.
So you've mentioned a lot of different types of like folklore and stories. And one of the things that you've said a few times, and I just wanted to kind of clarify and make sure that I'm understanding what you're talking about, is what do you actually mean by saga?
So a saga is basically a very long story. They have a few different types of genres of sagas. The earliest type of genre of saga is what they call the Icelandic family sagas. And these usually start with a family escaping Harald Fairhair in Norway and coming to Iceland and settling there. And then there's usually some kind of blood feud that happens with this family and another family. And it goes throughout generations. So the saga, like, so it's very, very common for a saga and those family sagas to start with a certain ancestor, and then it turns its attention to his son, and then maybe to his son, and how these long stories unfold over generations. And usually it's about a blood feud that continues until about the time of Christianization, and then they become Christian, and then they sort of learn forgiveness. I mean, again, like, it's this sort of Christian, these Christians that are recording these, and they probably put their own Christian spin onto whatever existing material from the oral tradition was there to begin with, which is debatable. But then later on, you also get like the genre of the Fornaldar saga, the sort of stories of ages past. And those are much more fantastic, but they're recorded later and more of like the, I think, 14th and 15th century is when a lot of them are recorded in Iceland. And they sort of become like these sort of fairy tale sagas where there's a lot of supernatural things occurring, which you don't get in the earlier recorded family sagas, which seem to be somewhat secular, almost like they're trying to record history for what it is. But of course, there's still some fanciful things that happen. There's a scene in Njal's saga, one of the most popular sagas, where the enemies of this family are coming around this cliff and they're waiting for them at the top of the cliff. And so then they see their enemies coming. So they're the most of the group goes down the cliff to ambush them. But one character, Scarpathen, has to fall behind because he didn't lace up his boots. And so he laces up his boots and he doesn't want to be counted out of the action and he wants to be first there on the battlefield. And so he jumps off the cliff and it says 18 L's and one L is 3 feet. So jumps down, and as he's coming down, he hits the leader with his axe in the face, and it gets kind of gory here. It says that the head sort of exploded and teeth from his enemy were skittering across the ice. So jumping 18 L's off a cliff and landing a hit perfectly like that. So some pretty fanciful things happen in some of the more secular sagas. But on the other hand, they don't talk about, pagan gods intervening as much as you might think they would.
So, I mean, this is really interesting. And I mean, I can also see like this kind of political power aspect behind it too. Of course, if you're from a big enough and wealthy enough family, you can have these stories of jumping like 18 meters and having a superhero landing, destroying your enemy. So something I am curious with this and this kind of projection of Christianity, of course, I mean, when you look at as Christianity spread in other areas, like with the Eastern Roman Empire and the Slavs, where they were like, well, you know, you can't enslave Christians. Well, I mean, that's literally where the term slave comes from, Slav, because they weren't Christian. But then it pushed the Slavs to become Christian so that they would stop becoming slaves for the Romans. But they could also then themselves get away with attacking other pagans. But so with this, I'm kind of curious, especially in this blending of the Scandinavian pre-Christian mythologies and Christianity, because of course, you know, Christianity is supposed to be peacefulness, forgiveness. And when most people think of the pre-Christian Scandinavian religions and mythologies, they are the opposite of peaceful. As you were talking before about, you know, hiring a guy to build a wall and then murdering him so you don't have to pay him. Doesn't seem like a very easy thing to blend with Christianity.
Medieval Christians definitely weren't in a drum circle singing Kumbaya, that's for sure. They were still, you know, these medieval monarchs that had an interest in taking land, taking more power as much as they could. Because they were Christian, there was that sort of mediator of the Pope. And of course, you can, I mean, go into a whole conversation about the political ambitions that the Pope at any given time was wrapped up in. But I mean, it was just that, though. It was just that sort of joining the EU sort of status. It didn't have everything to do with this sort of idea of forgiveness and whatnot. That's the message that these Christian writers wanted to convey, was that, you know, there was this idea of forgiveness in Christianity, which of course there is and was. So when it comes to the sort of folk legend of Olav or Helgi having the church built by a troll, there was also this condition at the beginning when he promised, like, if you build the church within a certain amount of time, we'll give you the sun and the moon. But also this condition that, like, he wouldn't find out the troll's name. And part of the story is the troll is about to complete the church within the allotted time, and he doesn't know what to do because he can't give the sun and the moon to him. So he's walking through the countryside, and as he's walking past the mountains, he hears from the mountains the lullaby that the troll's wife is giving to their little baby to rock them to sleep. And he's like, oh, don't you worry. Like, your father, Finn, will be back soon with the sun and the moon for you. And that's when he learns, oh, Finn is the name of this troll. And so it's sort of like the Rumpelstiltskin sort of motif, where if you know the supernatural creature's name, it's automatically their undoing. And so he says their name, he says the name of the troll, Finn, and then he bursts asunder.
Thank you so much for that. And, you know, I'm curious with all of this, because you'd mentioned before that, you know, these sources, these sagas, where we get most of our knowledge of these pre-Christian Scandinavian religions, were written by Christians a couple hundred years after the conversion. So I'm curious, like, how much can we really trust all of this if it's being written by Christians? Do we think that they might have changed some things? Is there any other evidence around that might go contrary to what they put forward?
Yeah, you see, that's always the important thing to keep in mind, especially when talking about the sources on the mythology. Like I said, they were recorded or written down 2 to 3 centuries after Christianization. And we basically, for the mythology, we have two main sources. The first source for the mythology would be the Eddic poems themselves, like Völuspá, Vafthrúðnismál, others. And sometimes it's called the Poetic Edda, and it's these collections of Eddic poems that are in the manuscript of Codex Regius. And we think the first time that these Eddic poems were written down was around the year 1270. But on the other hand, the secondary sort of source that we have for Old Norse mythology comes from Snorri Sturluson, and he wrote a book that's basically just called Edda. And that was probably written down around 1220. And the thing is like, I just said that the Eddic poems are the main source, but that Snorri wrote down his source before that. But the thing is that Snorri uses excerpts from the Eddic poems, and he quotes them all the time to sort of solidify his own interpretation of Old Norse mythology. And he explains the mythology in prose as opposed to the Eddic poems that give sort of cryptic references to what's going on, and also cryptic references to other mythological scenes as well. So you have Snorri Sturluson's Edda, and Snorri Sturluson was a politician, a historian, a mythographer. He's a very much sort of a Renaissance man in Iceland, but he, you know, some people suspect that he had political ambitions of becoming the Earl of Iceland, because he had a good relationship with the Norwegian king at the time in the 13th century. And it looked like Iceland was going to get absorbed into the Norwegian kingdom. And so if that happened, then Snorri definitely wanted to be the sort of ruler over Iceland, just below the king of Norway. But a lot of the Icelandic family sagas were also recorded or written down for the first time in about the 13th century into the 14th century. So in regards to how much can we trust these sources, how historical are they? That is the question. That's the million-dollar question in my field. When it comes to the mythology and the sagas both, to what extent does that reflect the actual beliefs of pre-Christian Scandinavians? And to what extent does the sagas reflect the actual history of Iceland and Scandinavia in general? The simple answer and the quickest answer is we don't know. We don't know. On the other hand, there's been a lot of debate, and I think the general consensus at this point is that both the Eddic poems and the sagas themselves, especially I think the family sagas, come from an oral tradition that is pre-Christian. But then we have to get into a whole discussion on variation, because I mean, medieval pre-Christian Scandinavia, Scandinavia in general, is just a huge geographical space. And then we're talking about centuries of transmission. So there must have been variation on the not only the myths, but also these sagas of families and whatnot. There must have been massive variation. And we don't know, because we don't have that recorded. And we don't know to what extent, but we can sort of theorize about what extent it does. And there is a lot of different schools of thought on that subject.
This is really fascinating. Of course, you know, we can't expect perfect history coming from especially mythological sources. But I'm kind of curious, do we think that, like, perhaps since these stories were told through the pens of Christians, do we think that might have impacted perhaps how the pantheon was seen? Because, you know, we got Odin, Allfather, perhaps being like more aligned with the all-powerful God. Or do we think that, do you think that Christianity had an impact on how we view this pantheon today?
Oh, I think certainly. I think, there's been a lot of, you know, scholarly arguments about how, because it was penned by Christians, as you say, that was when Christian influence happened. But I think I'm more of the school of thought where I think, I mean, these people have been living on the periphery of Christendom, of continental Europe for centuries, and have been trading with them and what have you. I think the influence of Christianity goes back a long time before Christianization actually happens on the mythology. There's actually an article by Terry Gunnell called "How High Was the High One?" And he argues in that this sort of cult of Odin, this idea of Odin as the Allfather, as you just said, how far does this go back? And he also argues that this incorporation of this cult of Odin as the Allfather and father of all the gods, and this sort of the head honcho, this was more of a radical change to Scandinavian pre-Christian religions than the actual introduction of Christianity. And there's been other theories that the cult of Odin was actually a sort of ruler cult, where if you were a king or nobility, you would worship Odin, and you would get this sort of this knowledge about the cult that maybe the layman wasn't privy to.
That's really interesting. So if this, like, kind of cult, I guess cult is a good word, right? Was meant for the elites. Well, what about everybody else in the society?
So we have what this onomastic evidence, these place names in Scandinavia, and some of them are named after gods. So you have like examples like Thor's Ekur, like Thor's Field, and it's debatable about how far back some of these place names go, but some people have used them as evidence for the popularity of a certain god here or there in Scandinavia. So like with a god like Thor, he's from the place name evidence, he looks to be very popular. There's all these Thor place names that pop up all over the place, especially in Iceland. But then when we're talking about like when we talk about like the god Odin, there is not a single place name for Odin in Iceland where these medieval sources come from on the mythology, which is really interesting, because in mainland Scandinavia, we do get some Odin place names. And so the question is, why is it happening in mainland Scandinavia and not in Iceland? And some people have theorized that, well, maybe it was because there was no central rulership in Iceland, like there was in Scandinavia, as there was the Althing. It was a sort of medieval parliament. But not only are there no Othan place names in medieval Iceland, but there are 25 Thor place names. And the next god who's the runner up to that amount of place names is Freyr. And Freyr has three. So it's 25 to three. It's a very interesting situation, although it's not conclusive by any means. But it is interesting to think about this level of variation in the mythology and cult worship and whatnot.
Absolutely. I mean, I find that really fascinating, especially because, you know, with the kind of general knowledge that people might have of Scandinavian mythology, or especially now with, you know, the popularity of the MCU and the Thor movies, to think that it's not necessarily so cut and dry, and to see that political influence. Something as well kind of playing off of this I'm kind of curious about is the representation of women, of goddesses, and perhaps how that might have been impacted through this Christian lens. Or, like, do we think that there was a significant change in the, I guess, social status of women and goddesses?
That's a very good question. Yeah, we have the goddess Freya, who is probably one of the most important goddesses. We have one story in Heimskringla that tells about how Freya actually taught the magic art of Sather to Odin. And Odin uses this, even though it's a form of magic that is usually reserved for females. And so he sort of takes on this female role when he uses it. And he's sort of criticized for, you know, taking on this female role and using Sather, but it comes from Freya in the source material, from what we know. There's also a scene, I think, that's in Snorri, that says that Freya actually takes half the slain from battles, and Odin takes the other half. And so that goes into that, like, well-known story that everybody in the public knows about, that you have to die in battle as a Viking warrior in order to enter Valhalla, which we call Valholt in the business, because it's closer to the Icelandic. But this idea that Freya chooses half the slain, not just takes half of it, but chooses, and it seems like Odin almost gets the short straw there, where it's only the leftovers that go to his hall, because Freya has her own hall called, like, Sessrumnir, which basically means, like, the hall of many chairs or something like that. But it's the sort of alternative Valhalla or Valholt that we don't hear about very much. So when it comes to the idea of goddesses and the role of the female in general, and how did that change before and after Christianity? The short answer is we're not sure. The long answer is that we have now identified some grave sites, which originally they were dug up much earlier, and because they were just a skeleton that happened to be buried with a bunch of weapons, older scholars assumed that they were male, and, like, this is clearly a Viking warrior, because there's so many weapons buried with them for them to go to the next life. But since then, we have, you know, DNA testing. We have much more complicated ways of determining things about graves. And so I think, like, the Birka burial is probably the most famous one. This skeleton, this person that was buried with a bunch of weapons, was assumed to be male because of all the weapons, and of course they'd be male, right? But then turns out that DNA testing, like, determined that they were female. And recently, I've also learned that this is sort of the jury's still kind of out on this or not, you know, not to belittle it or anything, but there were probably female warriors during the Viking Age. We don't really know to what extent this was common. There's some things in the sagas. I mean, there's a lot of sagas. There's a lot of... There is some evidence there to back the idea that there were female warriors. And I think this is all pretty much agreed upon. Although, like, when this first came out, it was sort of controversial in the field.
So I have kind of an interesting question. It's been tickling at the back of my brain. Obviously, there's been focus on Old Norse mythology with the rise and the popularity of the MCU universe movies. That's the Marvel Cinematic Universe, for those who aren't in the know. What does the public think they know about Old Norse mythology versus what there actually is to know based on those movies?
I mean, this is a very interesting topic. I think one of the biggest differences is that Thor and Loki aren't actually brothers. So Loki is actually Thor's blood uncle, and I'll expand upon that. So there's a slight reference to a myth where Odin and Loki become blood brothers. But then we have all these myths about Loki accompanying Thor on his adventures. For example, we have this telling of this myth by Snorri Sturluson. I think gets into it in detail. It's also referenced at other points, where Thor goes to visit Utgarthar Loki, he's a being, and we're not really sure if he's a Jotun, a giant, or if he's something else entirely, because that's also in the realm of possibility. But Loki accompanies him there. There's a myth about when Thor gets his hammer stolen. So his hammer Mjolnir, you know, like the source of a lot of his power, he basically wakes up from a nap one day and it's gone. And he's looking all over the place and can't find it anywhere. And then it turns out that Jotun, a giant, has stolen it. And in order to get it back, the gods have to concoct this plan of how to get it back. And so I think Loki was heavily involved with the hatching of this plan, because the giant says that he'll only give it back if Freya is given to him as his bride. Loki comes up with this plan. What if we dress Thor up as Freya in a wedding gown? And we can pass him off as Freya. And then as soon as he gets close enough, he can get the hammer back. And that's sort of exactly what happens. And Thor is not a fan of, you know, dressing up in a wedding gown at all. But you could sort of tell by reading between the lines that Loki, who's like dressing up as like the bridesmaid, is sort of having a lot of fun with this. And so they go to Thrym's, the giant's hall, and they present Thor as Freya to him in a wedding gown. And they're there during the marriage feast. And Thrym, the Jotun, the giant, finds it really suspect that Freya has eaten three oxen and down three barrels of mead and has this ferocious appetite, and he just makes some remarks on that. But then they bring Thor's hammer forward in order to sort of make the marriage sacrosanct, and as soon as they do that, Thor grabs the hammer, and then he kills all of the Jotnar, or the giants, at the wedding. And that's how he gets his hammer back. So I say Jotun instead of giant. And I sort of insist upon this Because when we say giants in the English language, we think automatically of Jack and the Beanstalk and the fee-fi-fo-fum variety of giants, which is not exactly what they were. In a lot of myths, there's no differentiation between the way the gods lived and between the way that the giants lived. It was just sort of understood that the giants are sort of an older class of supernatural beings. Sometimes they sort of manifest nature in general, but they are an older class, an older ruling class in the mythology. And a lot of the times, Odin goes to them to get knowledge of this or that or supernatural powers or what have you, you know? So the giants don't differ in stature between the gods and themselves. The giants have halls of their own and their own sort of societies that sort of mirror the way that what we call the gods have it.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I guess like kind of two things popping into my head, like one related to the MCU part, but also one kind of just generally about Jotun. So I'm kind of curious with this. Do we think that there might be any kind of connection with the Jotun and perhaps like Sami people or the, you know, Finno-Ugric people, given their kind of physical place up north and I'm far from an expert, but as well the nature deities and such, and then also beyond that, my favorite very non-MCU Loki thing, which I'd love you to tell us about, when he becomes a horse. But just those two things.
So when it comes to the Jotnar being a sort of mythological personification of the Sami, there's definitely been theories about that. Whenever in the mythology, whenever they talk about the Jotnar, they're usually to the east, or maybe to the north, or maybe to the northeast. So it could be the Sami, it could be the Finns in general, it could be, you know, those people over there with that crazy language we don't understand, and those are the other. Those are the other, just like the Jotnar are the other. In fact, Saxo Grammaticus, who has one of the earliest renditions of the mythology, he starts, like any good historian, with a sort of rundown of the geography. And he's Danish, and so he's sort of his bias sort of shows through in his geographical rundown. He's like, yeah, so we have the greatest place on earth, and it's Zealand, you know, where modern day Copenhagen is. And then we, to the north, we have Norway, and then to the northeast, we have Sweden. And he's like, and even farther east, we have what people call Finland. And he says, and there in Finland is where you find all kinds of motley barbarism, which is sort of telling about their worldview and how politics and geography relate to each other. And when it comes to Loki and his sort of character, I think it could be classified through the Master Builder myth, where the reason that the gods distracted the Jotun, the Master Builder, from finishing was because he was using a sort of magic horse that would carry all of these heavy bricks towards him, and then he'd lay them in place. So this is sort of characteristic of Loki and his involvement, is that he causes a problem and then the gods make him fix it. He's sort of a literary character in that respect. So when the Master Builder myth happens, they promise the sun and the moon and Freya to the Master Builder, which turns out to be a Jotun, but they don't know that at the time. But Loki tells the Master Builder that he can use his magic horse. And he's like, yeah, sure, go ahead, do it. Like, it doesn't matter. But then it does matter, because this horse is doing a lot of the work. And so then the gods commune together as the master builder is about to finish the project, about to finish the wall around Asgard. And they're like, listen, like, who told him he could use his own magic horse? And then they all find out that, of course, it was Loki. And they're like, look, listen, Loki, you gotta fix this. We don't care how, we don't, you know, you gotta fix it. So Loki, in order to stop the master builder from finishing his building project right up at the end, so Loki turns into a female horse and distracts the stallion that the master builder has been using. And so he's a, you know, he's a sexy horse out there, and he runs around, and then the, of course, the stallion is just enthralled with this prospect and chases Loki into the woods. And that's why the master builder can't finish in time. And then he doesn't finish in time, and the gods call upon Thor as soon as the master builder flies into what they call like a Jotun rage, like a giant rage. And then Thor just kills him, and they don't have to pay him. But then one of the most interesting aspects of this myth is it says that when Loki came back out of the woods in female horse form, he was pregnant with a foal, and he gave birth to a foal. And that was actually the fastest horse to ever exist. It was Sleipnir, which went on to be the horse that Odin rides upon, the eight-legged horse that Odin rides upon all the time throughout the mythology.
Well, I mean, my goodness, who knew?
Odin riding around on, I guess, if he's blood brothers with Loki, then riding around on his nephew?
His blood nephew, his I guess. Blood
nephew, the horse.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for that. It's, you know, that's always one of my favorite things that definitely doesn't come across in the MCU. And, like, yeah, Loki gets around in a lot of different ways. But, you know, we've been covering so many different things, touching on so many fascinating different areas. But, you know, we know we've taken up a lot of your afternoon, and we're really grateful for it. But, you know, at the end of every episode, we like to do something.
What do we like to do?
We like to ask something.
We like to, what could it be?
I think it could be the question.
The question?
The question.
Question time. So, at the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question, sort of call to action for our listeners. You know, they've been listening to this fascinating conversation. It's touched on a lot of different areas. What is something that they could do? It could be reading something, it could be thinking about something, you know, to find out more, to do more, to be engaged.
That's a great the question. I think what people should keep in mind and do in practice, if people really want to know about Norse mythology, they should go to the sources. And I would suggest maybe reading Snorri Sturluson's Edda. You know, there's plenty of translations available. Anthony Falks is a good translation of it. They should start with Snorri's Edda because it explains so many things in prose. It explains a lot of the mythological workings in prose. And then take a look at the Eddic poems themselves and what we have that has been passed down through centuries and generations, and those ideas that are conveyed through those myths and poems. I think that's probably the best thing you can do if you want to learn about Norse mythology, especially in this day and age of misinformation. Of course, there's the MCU that has a lot of fun with the sources and mixes up some things because it's, of course, it's Marvel, you know, it was a comic book. But I think you can get the best understanding from just tackling the sources yourself. Don't worry if you're not an expert on this or that or the other thing. They are fairly straightforward and they are explanatory, especially Snorri Zeta. Although take that with a grain of salt, because the Eddic poems are really the primary information that we have when it comes to the mythology. And when it comes to the sagas, you read translations of those as well, because there is a lot of great translations out there. If you want to dive into the coming of Christianity and the settlement of Iceland and what these people believed about how they came to be there in Iceland. But they wrote a lot of really great manuscripts. They wrote a lot of really great information down, something that they didn't really do in mainland Scandinavia. And I think just returning to the sources is probably the main thing that people can do in order to educate themselves on the situation of Norse mythology, especially when it's been so controversial, where white supremacists and even Nazis themselves appropriated this information and used it to their own benefit and put their own spin on it. This racism and whatnot is something you can't get away from in this field, and you shouldn't get away from it, and we should all deal with it to some respect. I think the best way to dispel racist myths about the mythology is probably to just look at the mythology itself. There's also this sort of myth about Odin taking away Freya's necklace, which the Brisingamen necklace, which is like a really big deal in the mythology. There's a story about how in order to get the necklace back, she needs to get two kings to wage war against each other for eternity. And one of the kings in one of the variants of this is from Norway. And the other king is from Saracen land, what they called Saracen land. So he was from Northern Africa. And she's sort of enticed to come up there and wage war against this other king until the end of time. In that legend, in that story, it's not until a Christian king intervenes in their epic battle forever that he comes up and ends the battle. But I think it's important to remember that the Viking world was much larger than we expect it to be as modern readers. It had everything to do with the Mediterranean. Scandinavians went down to Constantinople and they became mercenaries in what's called the Varangian Guard that the Constantinople emperor had. It was a mixture of different peoples, but a lot of peoples that had no political interest immediately in the Mediterranean political workings. And so some of them were Scandinavians, and it talks about this in the sagas as well, that some Scandinavians went down to Constantinople and became mercenaries for the emperor. They became part of his elite bodyguard. They gained a lot of wealth from that, and then they would return to Scandinavia at some point with all this wealth, and it's recorded in the sagas for all of the historical accuracy that's worth.
This is really interesting stuff. And I mean, I think that we get all these stories kind of on light or like really generously interpreted versions of these stories through things like the MCU. And I think that the reminder that there is a rich source material that these are drawing from, and that we shouldn't necessarily accept what we get from kind of these modern, you know, enterprises that at the end of the day are kind of just out to make money rather than preserve the story as it originally appeared. I think that's a great call to action and a great answer to the question and a great reminder for our listeners.
No, yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, enjoy the Marvel stories as they are. They're Marvel stories, you know, but they changed a lot of the mythology in order to fit their own Marvel universe and their own literary devices. But I think the sources themselves are very much approachable by the layman. You don't have to be an expert. You don't need Neil Gaiman and his book to explain it to you in narrative form, because it's already in narrative form, especially if you start out with Snorri Sturluson's Eda, and take that with a grain of salt, but then go from there and then read the Edic poems themselves. Read Völuspá, read Vafthrúðnir, read through all of them. And they're not hard to find. They're online. You know, you can find translations online. A good translation of Snorri's Edda, I would say, is Anthony Falk's. A good translation of the Edic poems is Ursula Drunk, that you can find online and probably at your local library as well. You can do this very easily. You know, like I said something about Neil Gaiman. So Neil Gaiman took the narratives from Snorri Sturluson's Eda and basically turned them into a book. And that's, you know, it's fine. But like from what I've read of that, like there's some things that it added in there that don't need to be there. And it's so accessible in itself. Like when it comes to a translation, it's so accessible itself to just read Snorri's Eda. And this will teach you a lot about the mythology that we have, but also keep in mind that this was 2 to 3 centuries after Christianization in Iceland.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I mean, that is such a huge thing, like people being able to like go and actually access these materials themselves, because I think it's a great point. Like these things are out there. They are easily accessible, especially in the day of the internet. And, you know, for this, and I think for things in general, it's really good for people to go and check it out for themselves and learn on their own, to break away from entertaining or very problematic interpretations. So yeah, Jesse, thank you so much for coming on and joining us. I mean, there's so many things touching into that I know we could go off for hours about too. I mean, with the that growth or size of the Scandinavian world and the all the experiences with the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantine Empire. But yeah, well, I mean, we can always have you back on sometime in the future. We can dive more into that. But thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been a real honor to be on the podcast.
Thank you to Jesse Barber once again for coming on and having an epic conversation with us. Please join us next month when we'll be speaking with Ksenia Hanacek about extractivism and decolonial environmental justice in the Arctic. From the cool rain and changing leaves of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Haglani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.